Rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Allen. To my right is Judge Meredith. To my left is Judge Toth. We'll hear argument this morning in docket number 18-1023, Shoemaker against Wilkie. Would counsel please state their appearance for the record?
Your Honor, Lawrence Westcott, Earl and Mooring, along with Patrick Berkshire with the National Veterans Legal Services Program for the appellant.
Thank you, Mr. Westcott.
Your Honor, Mark Hamill for the Secretary, and with me is Deputy Chief Counsel James Cowley.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Mr. Westcott, I understand you want to reserve some time for rebuttal. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
We'll make that happen, and you can begin when you'd like.
May it please the Court. This case is whether in the context of a non-adversarial claims process in which veteran submissions are liberally construed, whether the form of a claim withdrawal is important, and whether in all cases the withdrawal must be explicit, unambiguous, and done with a full understanding of the consequences of that withdrawal. Now, the Secretary takes the position that form is important and that the veteran does not necessarily need to understand the consequences of the withdrawal. Now, this court should clarify that the test applies to any withdrawal, whether it be oral or written, and should further clarify that a withdrawal is only effective if it is explicit, unambiguous, and done with a full understanding of the consequences of the withdrawal by the veteran.
Could I ask a very, very technical question to start out with?
Yes, sir.
So, the withdrawal, the first document, is at record 2801, the report of contact. Okay, it's dated March 29th, 2007. Okay?
Yes.
The rating decision is April 23rd, 2007. One of those two things, it seems to me, has to be wrong because otherwise he withdrew the appeal before he knew what the decision was. And that I'm not sure is right. And I understand none of the parties recognize this. And I think your brief, no criticism intended, actually assumed that the decision was in March and followed. So do you know if there's a mistake? Do you know which one of these things is wrong?
Your Honor, I don't know, but I would contend that the withdrawal doesn't meet the requirements for an effective withdrawal in the first place. Although it is explicit and it's unambiguous, but the question is there any indication whether there was any discussion with the veteran the consequences of that withdrawal?
Counsel, let me maybe consider offer a lifeline. I have March 23rd, 2007, so that would be 4 days before as the rating decision, and then the form 119, the contact as March 29th. I don't have the record in front of me, though, but that's just my notes. So I have a different sequence than Judge Allen.
This may be meaningless. It's just that if, in fact, these times are right and the date stamps are right, then it's impossible that this thing could be seen as a withdrawal of something because the thing had not yet happened. That's what I'm trying to say. It's a factual question. It may make no difference at all if, in fact, everybody agrees that one of these dates is either an April should be a March or a March should be an April. But if everybody says, no, these are factually what the situation is, I'm just concerned that we might never reach the weighty legal issues we're talking about because the board would have to explain to me how it is that a waiver could be valid when it's made prior to the thing it purports to waive. So I was hoping we could just clear that off the table right away, but it looks like we can't, and that's okay. You can think about it on rebuttal. That's a technical
point. Maybe I'll use that as sort of a segue to a legal question, which is I want to ask about the relationship between withdrawal and finality for just failing to pursue an appeal. So in the March, in the rating, the whatever it was, March, April of 2007, it appears there were three issues. Two were granted, and then there's one was the ANA issue was not granted. Assuming there had been no withdrawal, would the veteran have had to file an NOD and restart the appeal as to that issue? Because I know he filed an appeal as to that issue originally in 2005 and then submitted some new evidence, and then it was sent back down to the RO. So if that was denied, would the natural course be to file an NOD, or would that have remained in appellate status?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I was going on the basis of the fact that the AOJ had denied entitlement in the April timeframe, and that therefore the appeals had been timely perfected, and that it stood in an appropriate procedural status until the alleged withdrawal. So I don't know the answer.
Well, I mean, if you think about it this way, in a more general sense, right? I mean, normally a withdrawal has a legal significance where, say, there's multiple issues
right
in an appellate status, and one or more of those issues are withdrawn, and then the remainder continues in appellate status to an adjudication, right? At that point, it would be significant because presumably the withdrawn issues were not adjudicated, and then the issue would be, were they properly withdrawn or not, right? But if certain issues are withdrawn, and then there simply is no appeal after that, the withdrawal issue would largely fall away, and it would become one of finality, as simply, you know, the appeal was timely, and then it lapsed, and then there was no appeal. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes, I do. I can't answer that question. I would have to, I think, look at the record and examine the state of the record at that point to further address that question, which I apologize, Your Honor, I can't address it right now.
Well, assuming we can reach this for one of the reasons that, you know, we avoid these other things, let me tell you sort of my starting point, and I'd like you to respond to it, which is the regulation that we're talking about here is an interesting one, because it isn't just something that says this regulation is about A. It specifically says, except in the situation of a withdrawal at a hearing, and then it describes what has to be in a written withdrawal, right? So it simultaneously describes a written withdrawal and specifically says we're not applying this to things not withdrawn at a hearing.
Right.
Right? So DeLisio starts out and establishes the test. Explicit, unambiguous, with full understanding. Leave aside the fact that I don't understand what full understanding means, but just assume that's clear. Explicit and unambiguous, I think you can read into the regulation implicitly, because whether you call it explicit or unambiguous, or you focus on the language in the regulation that says a statement withdrawing an appeal, you know, if somebody said, I kinda sorta maybe wanna withdraw an appeal in some way, maybe, you know, the board would have to figure out, is that a statement withdrawing an appeal, which to me is six of one, half dozen of another.
Right.
However, I need your help understanding how we can insert into the regulation this full understanding concept, because DeLisio doesn't tell me where it comes from, and it's not in the regulation. And so wouldn't we be inappropriately adding to a regulation if we were to read in full understanding?
Well, the cases cited by DeLisio, though, do analyze both oral and written withdrawals. The Hansen case, for example, involved an analysis of a written report of contact in a case similar to this. The Coleman case, however, addressed both written and oral statements, while the Verdin case looked at substantive analyses of written communications. So this court has, in the past, analyzed written communications in making that determination as to whether the...
But, I mean, as a practical matter, right? I mean, Judge Olive's correct in that sense of it's virtually impossible for a fact finder looking at a piece of paper and some text to sort of discern the subjective intent behind whatever wrote it. Whereas at a hearing, right, the claimant can make a withdrawal and the hearing officer can ask some questions to sort of just to ascertain the subjective intent. Do you understand what you're doing? Do you understand the consequences? Do some follow-up and put it on the record so that at least there's a record basis that would allow a court reviewing it to, you know, something as to the subjective intent at the moment the waiver was made. I just don't see how it's possible in a written document for fact finders to sort of read it. I mean, they can judge it on its own terms, but then to sort of infer whatever subjective intent lay behind that and whether the person understood the consequences of it or not. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor, but I, with respect, I think that it is possible. It was done in the Hansen case, where the court said there that written report of contact was sufficient. But the court also looked at surrounding circumstances. And I think when you look at this case, we have additional communications in which Mr. Shoemaker clearly didn't understand that he had waived his claim. Where in Hansen, there was no pursuit of the PTSD claim at issue there.
Now, but that, it remind me, but I think that the factual scenario in Hansen was more equivalent to our decision in Warren, wasn't it? I mean, because it was a written report of contact by a VA official?
Yes.
So Warren, which we're bound by as a three-judge panel, treats that scenario, meaning a written report of contact, like a board hearing, right? So that is different, right?
Well, I think that the scenario in Warren, though, does involve the same type of written contact that you have here, but...
Explain that to me, because this would be significant, right? Because if in fact the contact here is the same as Warren, then sort of our work is really easy, and I'll write that opinion really easily, right? Because I'll say see Warren, and you know we'll be done. But in Warren, it was the person communicates to a VA official, and the VA official, like a scrivener, writes this down, right? And so what we said, you know, rightly or wrongly, was, well, that's got the same qualities to it as the withdrawal at a board hearing, in the sense that you're communicating with a VA official back and forth. And so we applied the full understanding test. But here, the report of contact form is actually filled out by his VSO representative.
Yes, that's true.
So that's functionally the same to me as if it were submitted by a private lawyer. If you had represented him at the time and wrote a letter that said exactly the same thing, we wouldn't treat that in the same way as Warren, right?
Well, I think that you raise an interesting point, Your Honor, because if it had been signed by an attorney has an obligation to explain, an ethical obligation, to explain what he's signing, what the type of pleading that he's filing on behalf of the veteran. So I think you could much more easily infer in that situation that the veteran did understand the consequences of his action. I think in a scenario where you have an accredited rep, that individual may not necessarily understand the full legal implications of a withdrawal. And so there's more, I think, of a burden on that representative to make sure that the veteran understands what's happening here, so that there should be at least more of a dialogue that the rep should record in that communication. For example, I explained to Mr. Shoemaker that if he really wants to withdraw his claim, then he can file a new one, but the clock has stopped. The clock will start again upon the filing of that new claim if that's what you really want to do.
What in the regulation imposes that requirement? It just says an authorized representative may withdraw the appeal.
That's not in the regulation, Your Honor. I'm reading that from the DeLisio case.
Right. Okay, so you've acknowledged, though, that 20.204 does control here, and you said it the requirements in 20.204 are necessary but not sufficient to effectuate a waiver. So I want to get back to something that Judge Allen asked about is, if there's a regulation here, unlike in a lot of the cases that you've been talking about, where the regulation governs the circumstances here of a written withdrawal, what authority do we have to impose requirements that aren't listed in that regulation?
Well, I think you have the same authority that you had in Warren, which I read slightly differently from Judge Allen, in that the court acknowledged the requirements of the regulation, yet also cited the DeLisio case in requiring that the veteran, that the withdrawal be explicit on the ambiguous.
If we were to find that those cases you relied on in your brief, in your reply brief, are distinguishable, either because they did not deal with 20.204B as it existed for purposes of this appeal, or because they dealt with a different type of withdrawal, then what are we left with? What authority do we have to impose a requirement other than what's in the regulation?
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I would argue that the case in Warren does control, and that it does give authority to this court to impose the requirement, in a system that is non-adversarial, where a veteran's submission should be construed liberally, that veteran should understand the consequences of that withdrawal.
So let me say, let's assume, and I think this was part of Judge Meredith's question, let's assume that we don't agree that Warren applies in this scenario on its terms, okay? Just that the differences there make a difference in this case. I am struggling with where DeLisio, and then you cited to these other cases, but then where those cases, right? Let's get to the bottom of the rabbit hole here. Where did this requirement come from, in your view? And here's what I mean. The court in DeLisio was acting in a vacuum. And what I mean by that is, there was no statute that said what was going on. There was no regulation that said what had to apply to a waiver in that context. And in fact, the only regulation at issue specifically carved out that scenario, a waiver on the record at a board hearing. So then DeLisio says, it is well understood that there are these three things that have to be in a waiver. And of course, the relevant one is full understanding. What's your view about the source of that? Did it come from sort of a general federal common law type void filling, no regulation, no nothing, we got to just provide a rule and we're going to say it, right? Did it come from some other place? Did it come from the Constitution, right? Because it matters to me, because fundamentally, Judge Meredith's question is the same one I had, which is, if we're going to read this into the regulation, we have to have a basis to say what we said in DeLisio, in the absence of a regulation, can apply when there's a regulation. And it all comes down to where, for me, where that full understanding concept came from as a matter of law.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that it does come from the common law established by this court in terms of the cases which led to the DeLisio holding. The Hansen court, the Hansen analysis was a written analysis of a written report of contact by a social.
Can I just stop you for 1 second, just because sure. I want to make this clear. And I don't know the answer to this question that I posed to you before. But if you could just directly tell me whether the appellant believes that there is a constitutional component to full understanding. And if you want to think about that and answer on rebuttal, that's totally fine. But I would like to explore that issue if you think there is.
Well, I think that we could look to the due process clause in that there should be, when a substantive right is being waived, And this is a significant what right that the veteran would have been giving up, that due process requires, that withdrawal, that waiver, that giving up of that right be done with a full understanding of the import of that waiver, particularly in a system that is designed to favor the veteran, to give solicitude to the veteran, to construe the veteran's submissions.
In civil law, waivers are, that's a different term, but waivers are generally done in writing, not in court on the record, and so they're construed narrowly against the party seeking to enforce it, right? And it's just a general sort of common law understanding of waivers. I mean, is it possible to read Warren as sort of implicitly kind of imposing that same standard? Because obviously, the waiver there was to a certain type of review, and then they construed it far more broadly to be a waiver of the entire appellate process. And our court found that just was not justified by the facts. And the point was they're reading waivers expansively against the veteran, and that can't square with a pro-veteran system.
And Mr. Wiskott, when you're answering Judge Toth, I've added some time for you. So.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, I fully agree with that. I believe that we could infer that type of reading into Warren, that we want to incorporate the principles of waiver into the withdrawal process to make sure that that waiver is done, again, I'm like a little broken record here, but explicitly, unambiguously, and done with a full understanding.
Right. I mean, as I said before, it's difficult to glean what someone's subjective intent is, but you can presume it's to waive nothing more than the bare minimum of what they wrote down.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you about the evidence that you've pointed to suggesting that the appellant may not have understood that he had withdrawn his claims? Part of the evidence is from 2011, and the purported withdrawal here is from 2007. What evidence is it that the board should consider in determining whether, assuming they go outside the document that was the purported waiver, how far out do they have to look? Does the evidence have to be contemporaneous with the document that was submitted that's the purported withdrawal, or is 4 years out? Is that okay for the board to still be looking as to whether that impacts the effectiveness of the withdrawal?
I think it depends upon the circumstances of the situation. In this situation, I don't believe we have any communications by the VA or the board or anybody acknowledging that withdrawal happened, so that the first instance between the alleged withdrawal and any addressing of this issue at all was 2011. And I think in a case where we want to give the veteran the benefit of the doubt, that's legitimate to do so.
So to what extent is it relevant to that inquiry that under the version of 20.204 that's applicable here, it says that the withdrawal is effective when received? So given that language, what authority does the board have to look at documents that post-date the withdrawal document?
Well, again, I think the authority is in the nature of the veteran's claim system, and that submissions of the veteran need to be construed liberally, and we need to give the veteran the benefit of the doubt here. I think that when you look at this, it said, but the veteran said he had filed for ANA back in 2004. The accredited rep didn't say, well, but didn't you withdraw that? I mean, there was no acknowledgement there. This is kind of really what we have here in this case. So I think in this situation where we don't have any evidence that this consequences of the withdrawal were explained to Mr. Shoemaker, that it's not surprising that he made the statement at this time.
Let me talk for a second about prejudice, if I could. The appellant here is seeking an effective date for SMC prior to 2011. To what extent does he have an obligation to come forward with evidence suggesting that he would have satisfied the requirements for aid and attendance prior to that time? If you can show that the earlier claim was still open or still pending because there was not a withdrawal, does he have to come forward with evidence showing that he could have received ANA during that time?
Well, I will note, Your Honor, that the board opinion did state that if aid and attendance would have been warranted because of his medical statements that were filed by his doctor in 2004 and 2005.
It would have been warranted, or that the appellant was contending that it would have been warranted?
The board stated that in its opinion.
Acknowledges the veteran's contention that it is warranted, I believe is the language you used. But aside from what the board said, what's the burden on the appellant in order to show prejudice?
I'm not following you, Your Honor.
In order to demonstrate that any error made by the board was prejudicial to your client, you have to show that the outcome could have been different. How do we get to an earlier effective date here? Even if there was a pending claim, is there evidence that he was entitled to the benefits prior to 2011? And what showing has been made? What showing are you required to make on that in that regard?
Well, I think that he does have a burden in connection with all of the relevant evidence under 7104D1, that the later evidence, though, could go to his state of mind in terms of his belief that the claim was still active.
Let's take a world in which we were to say that the legal rule was you have to affirmatively determine a full understanding of the withdrawal. Let's just assume that. And so we say the board erred because it didn't do that. I understand Judge Meredith's question to be, but what if he wasn't entitled to that benefit at all? So he appealed the denial. Let's just assume that the evidence was crystal clear that he wasn't entitled to the benefit at all. So his withdrawal of the appeal as to that issue was ineffective under our full understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand Judge Meredith's question to be, but no harm, no foul, if there isn't some showing, at least, that he might have been successful in the appeal.
Well, I think that we would need to consider the evidence that's on the record. And I think that's perhaps what the board may have been referring to, those medical statements that made by his physicians, which indicated that he may have been entitled to aid and attendance at that time.
I have one slightly unrelated question to what we've been talking about. In your initial brief, you had argued about a 2009 claim that should have been construed as also a request for special monthly compensation. Are you continuing to pursue that argument, or have you abandoned that?
Well, I think that we would pursue that if it was found that he had, in fact, withdrawn his claim, because I believe that this court finds that he had not withdrawn his claim for aid and attendance, that this becomes moot. So I believe that if we would probably go ahead and pursue that in the event that withdrawal was found to be effective.
All right, thank you, Mr. Ruskin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Hamill, before you begin, you can get an additional 8 minutes if you need them. You do not have to take them, but if you need them, you have them.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court. The DeLisio standard for verbal claim withdrawal cannot and should not be used routinely, in a routine fashion, in cases where there's a written withdrawal that complies with Section 2204. It's important to recognize the concerns that were addressed in the Delisio case. In Delisio, the board member stated the issues that were before the board, and there was a pre-hearing conference that was not recorded. And then at the hearing, the board member asked, are these the correct issues? I think they listed 10 or 15 issues. And the veteran said, yes, I think so. So the concern addressed in Delisio was that because we have a veteran who's pro se dealing with the VA, the board, that there was some kind of influence in order to have the claims withdrawn.
Could I ask you the same question I asked your brother on the other side? What is the source in your view? You've given a policy reason why Delisio might have done what it did. Where did that come from in your view? The source of law that the court relied on to create it? Is it federal common law filling a void? Is it the Constitution? What's your position on that?
I don't know, Your Honor. It came apparently from the three cases that they cited for that proposition, but there doesn't appear even from those cases to be specifically identify the nature of that right.
Okay, that's a good descriptive answer. So, because I agree with you, I don't think the cases say where it comes from. It just appears, like a phantom. Where did the phantom come from in your view? In other words, if you had to, if we issued an order that said submit a brief defending where full understanding came from, what was the authority the court could use to do that? What would be your best answer?
I think just, Your Honor, as a general proposition, when you waive rights, it generally needs to be an understood waiver.
Where it came from, then is the VA regulation then consistent? If as a general principle in the world, you need to have an understanding of the rights you're waiving, then the regulation seems weird. It's a technical term.
Your Honor, the regulation deals with written withdrawals, which are different from Delisio. Delisio had a concern that it addressed, and we think it fairly addressed. It said, when you're dealing directly with the VA, we're going to make an inquiry to protect the veteran, to make sure that the veteran knows what he's doing. When somebody submits something in writing, saying they want to withdraw something, either from the veteran or from their representative, it's presumed that they know what they're doing. Just like when this court receives a pleading in the mail saying that they want to dismiss an appeal, this court doesn't go behind it and say, how do we know this person really wants to do what they're doing? So in the same way this court treats motions to dismiss, either from an attorney or pro se, that's the way the board handled this. And that's the way the VA handles it. When a claims...
But just one thing before you... I understand you to be focusing just on the last requirement in Delisio, right? I'm assuming you, whether or not the words are used, the concept of something being explicit and unambiguous, that nature of things, it seems to me, is inherent in the regulation.
I agree, Your Honor.
And so, good. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. Okay. You can continue.
So the Delisio case addressed a specific concern, and we think impose a reasonable requirement that there be an inquiry into whether it's done knowingly. And the Acree case followed that. So in the Acree case, there was actually a representative, but most of the dialogue between the board and was between the board and the veteran. And so there was, in Acree, the Court of Appeals said, the verbal standard for claim withdrawal applies in this case because there was actually a dialogue between the veteran and the board. And really, Warren is just a reasonable extension of that.
The thing with Acree for a second. So the Federal Circuit clearly in its footnote 4, I think, says we're expressing no view on what the written withdrawal is, right? So it didn't decide the question before us. But it provides a reason why it thinks Delisio is good, right, when it adopts the standard. But its reason its reasoning about the sort of Byzantine nature of the system and very complicated and all that, it's hard to divorce that reasoning from a written withdrawal context, right? Because it seemed to shift from what was implicit in Delisio, which is this back and forth at a hearing, there can be misunderstandings, right? To something much more general about the VA system. Now, again, that may make no difference if, in terms of imposing something on a regulation, but as a rationale, it's hard to distinguish. There's not much daylight between them.
I think to understand those decisions, Your Honor, it's just important to understand the concerns in those cases. The concerns were that there was some kind of influence or coercion going on to get veterans to dismiss their claims. And so that's why we have the decision that we had in Delisio and Acree, and Warren goes right along with that because it was the veteran on the telephone with the VA employee. So in cases where the veteran is directly contacting someone from the VA and deciding to withdraw a claim, we do an inquiry. But when it comes in the mail and it's from the veteran or it's from the veteran's representative and it meets the requirements of 2204, we accept that. We accept that at face value. And it's no different from what courts do with pleadings, and there's nothing improper about that.
Ken, just stepping back, though, I just want to get your reaction to the Federal Circuit's language, right? Because in quoting some other cases, right? And so the person in ACRI actually, as you noted, had a representative at the hearing, right? And so, you know, the Federal Circuit says, as they, meaning the claimants, veterans, traverse the labyrinthine corridors of the veterans' adjudicatory system, veterans may lack a complete understanding of the consequences of a claim withdrawal. And then, right after that statement, the Federal Circuit cites this regulation, the written regulation portion, even though it said it's expressing no view on it. And my point just is, this labyrinthine corridor of the veterans adjudicatory system is not limited to the board's offices. Right? It's the VA process. And so it's hard to distinguish the Federal Circuit's logic there from the written withdrawal situation.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I can completely clear up the logic, but here's what I'd suggest.
And I'm not calling the Federal Circuit illogical on the record.
In Delisio, they talk specifically about having to be knowing. And the concern was that there might have been some influence. And I think what the Federal Circuit is saying is, even if there's not some kind of pressure by the VA to try and get someone to withdraw their claim, there is still this lack of understanding that the typical veteran maybe doesn't understand everything that's going on and maybe in a misunderstanding way waive their rights, not completely following. So if anything, maybe it's a little bit of an extension that, to the concerns that were addressed in Delisio, in Acree. But Warren is the same way, because Warren deals with a VA employee. Now, as a practical matter, I think this court has somewhat addressed this a little bit, it would not be practical for the VA to do an inquiry in every case they receive a written withdrawal. There's no process in place for someone who's receiving a written document to make any kind of determination of whether it's done with the full understanding of what's going on. If some kind of process were to be implemented to do that, it would really take away from resources that are otherwise being used.
Well, I mean, so I'm sympathetic with that and the concerns Judge Toth raised about how on paper it would work. But, you know, if we said, no, there's a source of law that lets us add this to the regulation, right? And let's put that aside, because I'm not sure what that source of law is, but let's just assume it is. And we told the VA, you have to affirmatively make a determination in every case, including a written withdrawal, that there's full understanding. My bet is what you would do is make a form, and the form you would require appeals to be withdrawn using a form, and that form only, and have on the form essentially the equivalent of something like in a criminal case would be like a plea colloquy. You know, if you were pleading guilty, you are giving up the following rights, and you'd have that. And there might be litigation over whether that was sufficient. But I mean, so I understand that following up is not as easy as it would be orally, like our conversation, but there are ways that could be fixed. And that wouldn't be a reason not to do something if the law otherwise imposed the requirements.
Understood, Your Honor, but I would say you can't get every veteran to submit a form. I mean, some veterans want to be done with the process. they're happy with what they got, or they're just too frustrated and they want to be done with it. And for the VA to try and chase somebody down to get them to appear at a hearing or to fill out, even just to fill out a form, it's not always going to be able to be done, because we don't always have the cooperation. There's no way to force the cooperation of a veteran to provide information when they want to be done with a claim.
True, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, and I think it's probably not a fertile ground to do, right? Because if, let's just assume that the thing, and I, again, tipping my hat, I think the only way that we could say that full understanding is implicit in this regulation is if that requirement is dictated by the U.S. Constitution. I have not conferred with my colleagues, but for me, that's it. If I determined that the Due Process Clause required full understanding, the fact that some veterans couldn't be chased down would not be a reason to say, but, you know, we'll give the government a free pass under the Constitution, right? So it seems to me that the much better way to think about this is, you know, that we just can't insert those words. Just a thought.
Okay, Your Honor. I did want to address one other point about the facts in this case. So in this case, we had not just a withdrawal that complied with 2204. It went beyond 2204. It provided reasons. The veteran wanted to withdraw his claims because he was happy with what he had already gotten. It provides an explanation. And we don't just have one, but we have a further clarification beyond that. And then when he finally decided to inquire about what happened with his claim, it was 4 years later. And all he said was, nothing's happened with my claim. Well, he's certainly correct, nothing happened with his claim. Nothing happened with his claim because he withdrew it. And he makes no allegation here that I never told my representative to withdraw it. I didn't withdraw, this was a mix-up in the paperwork. There's no kind of allegation here. So even if there was some kind of case where there was a need to address it in a board decision or do some kind of inquiry, we don't have the facts here. The facts here are he complied with 2204, he went beyond 2204 and provided reasons for that, and waited 4 years later and said he didn't know what was going on with this.
So on that point, I'd like to follow up when I talked to the appellant's counsel about what evidence is it that the board is obligated to look at in determining whether there was an effective withdrawal? Is it just the document, the written document that purports to withdraw the appeal, or do they look at the surrounding circumstances and evidence?
Your Honor, in a typical case, you just look at the document. If it meets the requirements of 2204, it's effective. That's not to say in certain cases somebody might make an allegation that requires examination of other evidence, but that's not what we have here.
Well, so what if the day one the person submits something that says, I unambiguously and expressly withdraw my appeal as to service connection for headaches, and then the next day the person sends a note to the board that says, and I am so excited today that I withdrew that appeal yesterday because now I win and I'm service-connected for headaches, right? Totally off the reservation, so to speak. The board would somebody would have to consider that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Somebody would have to address it.
So what's the cutoff? Is it that it has to be contemporaneous with the withdrawal document? Is it just that 4 years out is too far? Does it matter what I asked counsel earlier about the effective date of the withdrawal? If it's already taken effect, does evidence postdating it matter?
I'm going to answer the question. In this case, based on the allegation, it shouldn't be addressed. Whether we could address something that happens in the future, I would say just yes, based on the, for example, looking at equitable tolling. Like sometimes someone may have an attorney and may be abandoned or whatever happens and maybe not aware of what goes on. Those type of claims can be brought years later. And if you've got a good explanation, you can get equitable relief under equitable tolling. So I would say it depends on the situation. In this case, you don't go beyond the papers. In another case, maybe you do have to go beyond the papers. Maybe you have to hear what the veteran has to say and the reasons. And things are a little different in this case because he had a representative.
Could I ask you to address, and it doesn't have to be at this moment, but it seemed like you were transitioning, The two points that came up at the beginning of the argument, one is my point about the dates. I'm just confused about the dates. And the other is, and I'm not going to try to restate Judge Tote's question because he can do it, but his question about finality. If you could, at some point before you sit down, address both those points.
You're correct, Your Honor. I was looking at the record about the discrepancy in the dates, and I obviously there is a discrepancy because he's talking about something that
Hadn't happened.
Right. I'm not sure what happened with that. I'm not sure where the discrepancy is. I can look more into that, Your Honor, but I don't know, and I apologize. I don't know the answer to that.
No, don't apologize. I've had this case for a very long time, and only yesterday a very diligent law clerk pointed out to me that, in fact, there would have to be a time machine for this to have happened.
Yeah, so we treated it as if he was withdrawing a claim that was actually a valid claim at the time. So that's why we responded in the way that we did. And Judge Tote, the question about finality?
Sure. Yeah, maybe I can sort of restate it this way, because we'll put aside the sort of crossing in the mail, the withdrawal, and the rating decision. But so let's assume Mr. Shoemaker hadn't withdrawn the claims. And so in April 2007, it appears he gets relief on two of his three claims, right? The ED and the SMC for automobile, but not for the ANA.
That sounds correct, Your Honor.
Right. So now it had been in appellate status, sent to the board, and then remanded. He submitted new evidence and then went back down, in my understanding, to the RO who made that adjudication. So the normal course of events, would he have had to have submitted an NOD on that denied claim? Or would it have, in a sense, remained in an appellate status by virtue of the fact that it was on remand? That was a difficult question. I spent a lot of time.
I do believe that it remains in appellate status because it's on remand. That sounds correct to me.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure on that.
If we, and again, we have not conferred on anything about this case, but if we were to give the parties some time to think about particularly Judge Toth's question, although maybe the factual question about the date as well, and give you a time for supplemental briefing, would that be acceptable to the Secretary?
It would be, Your Honor.
Because I think Judge Toth's point is an important one that I had not considered before, and it is, I understand, it's hard for you to do it on the fly up there because it's hard for us to do it on the fly up here, and so this seems to be an important point.
I'd like to finish up with just talking about the cases from the reply brief. Appellant attempts to argue in his reply brief that Delisio applies to written withdrawals, but Delisio, of course, doesn't go beyond addressing withdrawals at hearings. The cases cited by Delisio are interesting, Hansen, Kalman, and Verdon. Interesting that appellant relies so much on Hansen. In Hansen, like Delisio, it specifically stated 2204 did not apply because the claim was still before the regional office. But the result is pretty significant. So just like in our case, it was a report of contact, but it wasn't from the representative. It was from a social worker who worked for the VA. And there's no, the court said there's no record of a contemporaneous objection to that, to the VA not adjudicating his claim, which is just like our case. It was 4 years later. There was no contemporaneous complaint. But yet this court in Hansen found that that evidence provided a plausible basis for the board's finding that appellant withdrew his claim, and therefore they found the board's decision was not clearly erroneous. So it seems like to be the same as what should be the result here. There was no clearly erroneous decision. We had a written withdrawal. Delisio and Acree don't apply to written withdrawals, and we don't have a contemporaneous objection. We really don't have a complaint that is adequate to require the board to discuss anything further. All he said was nothing happened with this claim. Nothing did happen with this claim because he withdrew it. As for Kalman and Verdon, both of them affirmatively state that 2204 did not apply, and so they don't support appellant's argument that Delisio applies to written withdrawals. And so based on the arguments presented here and in the Secretary's brief, the Secretary would ask that this court should affirm.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamill. Mr. Westcott, we'll give you your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court? I would like to also address the finding in Hansen. I think it is interesting in that if it's so difficult to ascertain the intent from a writing and looking at the surrounding circumstances, it was possible to come to a finding that the veteran did understand the consequences of his actions. The difference there is that he didn't raise it until until the point of appeal. Mr. Shoemaker did at least raise it. Yes, it was 4 years later, but it was in the context of a report of contact. It wasn't in the context of an attempt to appeal to reinvigorate his claim at the appellate stage. So I think that that is an important distinction. Another point that I would like to address is the idea of written communications in terms of being signed by attorneys versus accredited representatives. I would agree that had the withdrawal been by an attorney, by a pleading, that again, it would have been effective because of the obligation of the attorney to make sure that the veteran understood the consequences of that withdrawal.
So let me just, so in this case, if this had been submitted by a lawyer with exactly the same scenario, you think the result is different?
I think it is, because if it is signed by an attorney, the attorney has an ethical obligation to make sure that whatever is the substance of that particular pleading, that his client understands, his or her client understands what the import of that pleading is. So I think that an attorney would be obligated in that scenario to explain to the veteran all the consequences surrounding his appeal. And if the accredited rep had done that and documented, maybe Mr. Shoemaker wouldn't have been so happy at that point, because then he would have been aware that, you know, I can't get an earlier effective date because this claim is gone, it's withdrawn. So I believe in this scenario that an accredited rep needs to give a little more. If a veteran comes to an accredited rep, there he is right there. So you don't have to chase him down. If that veteran says, I want to withdraw a claim, the rep could then say, hey, wait a minute, you understand what you're doing here? And then document that conversation. He says, yes, I explained to the veteran that if you withdraw your claim, that you're done in terms of that claim. You can't get compensation for an earlier effective date. You can come back and you can file a new claim, but it starts at that point. So I think that that's a very important distinction, particularly when you're talking about a significant gap in years. So I think those are all the points that I wanted to raise. If you have any additional questions.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both parties for very helpful arguments in this case. The matter of Shoemaker versus Wilkie is now submitted for decision. The court will stand adjourned, and we'll come down and greet counsel.